second case for today, 002493 Village Food Liquor Mart versus H&S Petroleum Inc. First counsel will be Robert E. Hankel representing H&S Petroleum et al.
May it please the court, counsel. This matter comes before the court on an interlocutory appeal on the trial court level, which was accepted by the Court of Appeals, Second District, which then certified it to the Supreme Court, certification being accepted. The nature of the suit, the underlying suit, is a minimum markup claim arising under Section 100.30, parent 5, small m, of the statutes, a private cause of action, which permits any person injured as a result of a claimed violation of minimum markup law to sue for damages arising from that injury times 3, or for $2,000 per day for violation, whichever is greater. The issue that arose in the trial court was whether or not the defendant, whom I represent, H&S Petroleum, was entitled to a jury trial. Demand was timely made for a jury trial. The motion was made to strike that by the plaintiff respondent. The trial court granted that motion primarily based upon a decision of the Court of Appeals, State versus Ameritech Corporation. State versus Ameritech was decided by the Court of Appeals dealing with Section 100.18 of the statutes, same chapter, obviously different provision. That case, that decision was appealed to this court. Unfortunately, an equally divided court resulted in no decision at this level, with the consequence that Ameritech Corporation was affirmed. The issue is whether a litigant, where there is a statutory claim, has the right to a jury trial if that claim is new or was not recognized by the common law, and we have a dispute whether or not this is a claim that would be deemed recognized by the common law within the meaning of Ameritech. Factually from Ameritech, and I'm going to jump ahead a bit to admit that I am going to recommend to the court that Ameritech be overruled in the event it does stand for the proposition found by the trial court. But I believe there is a distinction when one looks at the way Ameritech analyzed it, and I recognize that this would require carefully limiting Ameritech to its facts. Ameritech was a statutory civil forfeiture action and a request for injunctive relief. It was not an action between two private to non-governmental litigants, and it did not involve a claim for money damages. That's the distinction that I can draw. It may make no difference at all. The court may decide that. And if it does not make a difference, then we move on to the next point I make, that I think Ameritech should be overruled on two bases. One, it doesn't rely upon the preceding authorities, it misreads them in the first instance, and secondly, that even if it does rely on those prior authorities, the courts, in the interest of preserving the jury trial right for a vast number of types of cases in Wisconsin, the right to a jury trial should overrule that line of cases.
Before you get to your overruling argument, you had made two distinctions. One, in response to Justice Wilcox's inquiry, dealt with it was involving the government rather than private individuals. And the other distinction you indicated was that Ameritech was not a claim for money damages. And
I should add something else to that. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. But the other aspect of that is I believe that there were cases, and I recognize it's not too easy to find them in the territorial court system, but there were territorial court decisions which dealt with business-type torts, some of which I've cited, in my brief in support of the contention that the type of action that this is, which is a competitive tort, price-cutting, wrongful competition, that those types of cases did exist in 1848 at the time of the adoption of the Constitution of the State of Wisconsin. Different kind of claim from the type of claims involved in 100.18, the unfair trade practice provision. So that I should add that that is an additional basis for not saying that Ameritech should be distinguished, but rather that we're in conformity with Ameritech, by, even if we say that a jury trial is, that we're entitled to in this case. And I'm sorry, I think I interrupted your question, or maybe I anticipated it.
No, you interrupted it. And my question was, with regard to the first of the initial two distinctions that you made in response to Justice Wilcox, you seem, in my perception, to say, well, okay, maybe that's not such a big difference. You know, if you don't think it's a big difference, then overrule it. What about the second distinction? Is that a big difference? Is that a difference of moment, or is that no big deal either?
Well, I think that's a large difference in the sense that you really have more of what you look at as a legal cause of action when you have a private litigant suing for damages as opposed to the government that could be deemed it is or isn't suing for damages. It's a civil forfeiture. That's not necessarily tied to any damages. It's rather in the form of a fine as determined as a matter of public policy. So it is. I think that is a significant difference.
What, if any, does that difference make as you tie it into the argument that the statute in question, I don't know, 100.35M, is more concerned with remedies? That's the argument you advance, rather. And that a distinction you're advancing is remedy, that is for money damages by a private individual. Do those two arguments blend at all, the distinction that you're making and what you're advocating is the purpose of 5M?
They may to some extent, but the idea of the remedies in 5M is it's a multiplier. And it has an alternative method of determining damages if injury has been caused by the violation. So to that extent, that remedy changes what would be the potential claim of Village Liquor if it had just sued for unfair trade practices, price cutting, predatory pricing. If it had just sued for that, it would have been limited to actual damages. What the statute does is it multiplies those damages potentially or even poses an alternative of a $2,000 a day violation, which may be an issue that comes up here again someday. But anyway, that that particular remedy is there, but the basic damage issue, was damage caused by this wrongful business conduct, that's still there and it's still a legal issue. Like antitrust, where damages can be doubled or tripled depending on federal or state law, like civil rights laws, all of these, many of these statutory laws are implicated by the courts, by the Ameritech's implications, or if one takes it to the extreme, that any kind of statutory remedy that did not exist at the common law in 1848, which certainly would include civil rights, wrongful death, and go on and on, there is no right to a jury trial unless the state legislature would decide to grant that right, which it hasn't in many instances. Okay. Moving on to Ameritech and the cases upon which it relies, there are a number of decisions, beginning with General Drivers and Helpers Union, Pan, and so on, which Ameritech relied upon in finding that there was a trend of cases, a series of precedent that supported the proposition that in a statutory claim or in a claim that did not exist exactly in the common law would not entitle a party to a jury trial. looking at those cases. However, they don't support that proposition. You look at General Drivers and Helpers Union. That case states that the court was not dealing with a mere action to recover money damages. Rather, it noted that labor practice proceedings was in the nature of an equitable proceeding, and a money award is simply incident to that equitable relief. So the General Drivers case looked at the equitable nature of the claim before it. Similarly, in Hayen, this was a domestic abuse injunction case, again, an equitable type of proceeding. Town of Burke dealt with an annexation ordinance and voting, the validity of an election contest. Again, something that would be typically, in the common law, have been determined by warrantal or mandamus or proceeding in equity. Again, looking at the equitable nature of it. Looking at the Powers case simply gave to the court, the judge presiding at a jury trial, the power to reduce or raise an award, giving that option to a party. Again, something not inconsistent with the jury trial. Right. In Bechdel versus City of Viroqua, the plaintiff in that case contended they had a right to a jury trial in a special assessment, a reassessment situation. Again, not a typical legal remedy, but rather something in the nature of a purely statutory proceeding or one that was equitable in nature. The closest one comes to a situation where a right to a jury trial existing in a case at law has been overturned are in the workers' compensation cases. The primary case relied upon by Ameritech, Berggren versus Staples, dealt with the rights of a subrogated party claiming that their right to a jury trial had been violated by virtue of the exclusive remedy provision of Chapter 102. The court in that case noted that in common law that third party did not even have a right to bring a suit, but moreover, the court looked at the remedy of workers' compensation and the basic relationship between the employer and the employee, finding that, in effect, there was a waiver of the right to a jury trial when an employee entered into the employment contract. Every one of the cases that Ameritech relies upon, when one looks at them carefully, involves an equitable proceeding, a purely statutory proceeding that would not have been a case at law, no matter how one would characterize it traditionally, or thirdly, the workers' compensation system, this massive reworking of a whole area of law. With respect to that, I note that in the federal cases cited, and I agree, though they are not binding authority on this court, however they are persuasive authority, in the cases cited from the United States Supreme Court, one of them, if I find it, again, I'll have a fine time pronouncing this, G.N. Van Serrera versus Nordberg, the court noted that Congress could develop an entire scheme of handling particular kinds of claims and provide remedies other than a jury trial, particularly when those remedies were delegated to a branch of the government in which jury trials would not be held in administrative court, similarly to workers' compensation.
Counsel, let me interrupt you if I can. What rule of law are you proposing? As I understand your briefs, the first rule you're proposing is it fits under the Ameritech case. Ameritech is distinguishable on its facts and law, and the double-barreled standard of Ameritech, if applied here, is perfectly acceptable, right?
Correct.
But if you lose at that, you want us to overturn Ameritech.
That's right, Your Honor.
What rule of law do you propose we adopt relating to jury trials and civil cases, right? Where there's a statute, that's what we're talking about here, right?
When there's a statute, certainly. My argument is that the existence of the statute has little fundamental relevance, the rule of law I propose is the same rule that, frankly, I thought prevailed in trials in this state for the 20-plus years that I've been practicing until Ameritech came along, until it was interpreted. And that rule would be that when there is a case at law, as one would define a case at law in the common law, when the
non-equitable.
But right, when the merger of equity, at the time when the merger of equity and the law courts occurred, that when that exists, you have the right to a jury trial for those matters that would fall within that definition. Does that mean that anything that would involve a suit for damages would entitle one to a jury trial? Perhaps not. Does that mean that any remedy that one would think of as justifying you to trial by jury would justify you to trial by jury? Perhaps not. But in the biggest, most instances, when you look at the federal cases, the United States cases, they look at what kind of cases do we have in the common law and what kind of remedy do we have.
You see the United States Supreme Court cases interpreting the federal constitution as different, a different law than Ameritech.
I don't think they're different, but I recognize that the courts have distinguished them in Wisconsin mainly by saying that the courts here, follow the Wisconsin constitution, which is not the same as the federal constitution. It's not. There's a slight difference in the wording, and there's a difference in interpretation. But I note that those United States Supreme Court cases did go back, and they said Parsons, I can't remember the case that cited, they go back to cases that would have been in the common law in 1848 when the Wisconsin Constitution was adopted. But I agree, the law in the state is to the effect that our right to a jury trial is determined with reference to our Constitution and not with respect to the United States Constitution, so long as we're dealing with non-federal issues.
Your view is Ameritech changed the law?
If it's interpreted the way it's contended, yes. And in fact, I personally don't think Ameritech was decided correctly in the first instance. However, there are distinctions, and it can be limited to its facts without having to overturn that decision.
If we would have to overturn Ameritech, what other cases subsequent to Ameritech, which relied upon and cited to Ameritech, would we also have to modify or reverse?
I'm not aware of any. I'm not saying that there aren't any. I'm not aware of any. Most of the cases that deal with the jury issue are, as I very quickly went through them, they deal with injunctive relief, with incidental damages attached to it, the nature of an equitable proceeding, or something that's purely statutory, or I missed the juvenile case, and with respect to juvenile delinquency proceedings, it's kind of interesting because the court later found that the juvenile had the right to a jury trial because of a statute. So I don't know how powerful the impact of that first portion of their decision was, but it is there.
What are the policy reasons in favor of a jury trial?
Well, first of all, I happen to be a believer in the jury system, but I suppose that's just a matter of belief, something that's ingrained in me. I think it is a very important right that individuals and companies, corporations have in this society to prevent or to make sure that a jury of their peers decides the facts and how those facts apply to the law, apply to the complaint being raised. I think that's a powerful reason. Another reason is I think that it is a serious danger exists that if this court is to affirm Ameritech and to, in effect, broaden it to cover this instance in Section 100.30, that there are other statutory remedies or statutory causes of action that did not exist in 1848 as we narrowly define existence, if you define it that narrowly, where there would be no right to a jury trial. And I've mentioned some, wrongful death, civil rights, go on and on, any number of types of claims are in the right to a jury trial and then would be in jeopardy, a powerful public policy reason. But I mean, here we've got a company suing another company, claiming very, very serious damages, as much as $2,000 a day or more, and in this instance, there are 100-some violations alleged, I believe, something on that order. So these are significant claims, and the parties should be entitled to, I think as a matter of public policy, the right to a jury trial if they protect that right by properly requesting it.
What do other states do? I mean,
There was a time when I may have known that answer, and I'm sorry, I can't represent to you what it is. I think there's a split, but I don't want to, without going back in my old memory, I can't give you the actual data.
What is the closest action known to the common law that parallels the Unfair Sales Act?
Well, in the Wisconsin cases that I found, the closest one would probably be the equivalent of fraud in a business setting, because this is a type, an unfair pricing case, I think, is a type of fraud kind of claim where where somebody is pricing something at a level that, in effect, is not enough to make a profit, representing to the customer that this is the price for that product, when really it's not the price for that product if one fairly competes, with the result that a competitor is damaged, and then, of course, the idea is eventually to create a monopoly or at least drive out some competitors.
That's not a fraud on the competitor, though.
No, it's a fraud on the customer. But I'm trying to give you the closest that I can come up with, and that's what I came up with in looking, again, in the territorial law. I believe that price cutting would have entitled a company to sue in the common law. And when you look at the Parsons versus Bedford quote, which was quoted in Chauffeur's Teamsters case in U.S. Supreme Court, what the Supreme Court did in quoting this 1830 decision was look at suits in which legal rights are to be determined in contradistinction to where equitable rights alone are recognized and equitable remedies administered. A two-part analysis, but the most important part of that analysis is what kind of remedy is being sought. Business torts existed in the common law, unfair competition. This is a type of unfair competition.
Well, isn't the essence of it some sort of predatory pricing in an effort to injure a competitor?
Yes.
Is there any evidence that has been recognized at common law?
Again, I can't represent to you that that's the case. I believe it is, but I don't have the authority to cite to you. So I can only say I think that that's what the looking at the old texts, Blackstone and so on. This type of claim is out there. The terms are archaic, probably beyond my clear understanding of them, but it would certainly beyond my clear understanding of them, I should say. But, certainly that type of claim was out there, that being, by that type of claim, one business hurting another business by the way in which it conducted its business, which is what's being alleged here. Now, statute comes into play. That's granted. The statute gives you some evidentiary definitions. It says if you prove this, you got a defense. If you don't prove that, you got a problem. This is what your remedies are. Times damages, still have to prove damages, but times three, and so on. So the statute changes the manner in which you would prove the case, defend the case, and what the amount of damages that you would obtain if you are successful.
Counsel, it seems to me that as a threshold, you can approach it in a narrow or a broad way, and your analysis and perhaps even your conclusion can be different depending on how broadly you frame the issue. Is there predatory price fixing? Are there predatory price fixing cases in existence in 1848? Is one way to. And it's more narrow. Are there business tort cases in existence in 1848 that deal with unfair business practices? It's a bit more general. But in looking at your opponent's brief, they take the five cases that you rely on with regard to similarity, you know, and how similar is similar is the question here. But they take the first one, the Vieth or Pillay case, say that's an action for slander. I don't care how broadly you define it. That's not in a business a tort for unfair competition. The second one, they say, is an action for trespass. You know, that's out of the park. The third one is an action on a subset on an unpaid note. The fourth one is a replevin action. And the fifth one, they say, is an action to recover damages for breach of the covenant of title to certain premises. And so you're not even in the ballpark, even if you define it broadly, they argue. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, it's correct that we're not dealing with a third party. You're always dealing with two parties dealing with each other in a contractual setting in those cases, except for the slander case. In business, slander is a viable cause of action, and in a sense, this falls within that kind of category. You're saying, here's our price, there's their price. You're damaging them by the price you're posting. And I recognize that that's not the way you're going to look at it, because you're going to look at dollars and cents. But in effect, that's what the competitor is doing. And certainly, one competitor could damage another competitor. Now, if the court can't, if it can't define the type of cases that entitled one to a jury trial in 1848 broadly enough to include business competition generally, I don't have a better case that I can give the court right now. There may be one out there somewhere in Penny, I don't know, but I did not find it.
Well, you do make the argument on page 13 of your brief that according to the common law writings like Holmes and Bill, that there was recognition of cheating, deceit, and fraud in business dealings and commercial offenses.
Yes, I do. Thank you for helping me, but yes, those general treatises were out there. I didn't run down those cases, but those treatises, which are recognized authority, did describe those kinds of commercial offenses as entitling a person to a jury trial.
It seems then that your argument is that, and you make this at 14, I don't know if it works, though, that you got cheating, fraud, deceit in commercial law, that you didn't have gasoline for cars at the time. Right?
I don't believe so.
No cars, so you had some sort of flammable commodities, but which may or may not have been sold, that you don't have to find a case directly on point of sale to consumers, but that once you got the baseline of business law and deceit, you can take it from there. It grows, and it doesn't stop at 1848.
I agree with that, and that's why I cite Kircher versus Sorensen. Common law grows, and you have to, it is what it is back in 1848, but it does change over time.
That's another way of saying what Justice Bradley said as to the level of generalities. If you have a high level of generality, like cheat, fraud, and deceit in commercial offenses, many of today's issues that arise in under these statutes, these fair dealing statutes, would entitle to a jury trial. If you take a very narrow view, as she said, of cheat, fraud, and deceit in commercial ventures, you don't grow as to jury trials. Now, the common law grows, but the Constitution doesn't grow. That's the basis of the dispute here.
I agree. That's a good description of what's involved here. Whether or not this is the type of case in the common law in 1848 that judge would have said, you're entitled to a jury trial.
And you agree that the Wisconsin Constitution has been interpreted that as that you look to 1848 to determine the causes of action that are entitled to jury trials. You agree with that?
I agree. You look to 1848. It's a question of whether you're looking. My disagreement is how narrow that examination is.
Thank you, okay. Counsel.
Thank you.
Tier.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Rotier, and along with my associate Sarah Zylstra, I am here representing Village Food and Liquor Mart. Village Food is the trade name of a gas station convenience store that is in operation in Sturtevant, Wisconsin, near Racine. Village Food is the trade name of a small family-owned corporation that basically consists of three members of the Shaw family, Ajvin Shaw, Yusa Shaw, and their son Priya Shaw. And Priya Shaw is here as a representative of Village Food. Across the street from Village Food in Sturtevant is a gas station convenience store owned by H&S Petroleum, Inc. Village Food brought suit against H&S Petroleum on the grounds that for a one-year period between March of 1999 and March of 2000, H&S Petroleum had violated the minimum markup requirements of the Unfair Sales Act with respect to the sale of gasoline on about 100 separate occasions. Village Food has alleged, and it's prepared to prove, that it has been threatened with injury and has been injured as a result of H&S's disregard of the Unfair Sales Act requirements. And in this action, Village Food seeks to recover the monetary damages and the litigation costs that are available to a private litigant under subsection 5M of the Act. That subsection 5M is a relatively recent addition to the Unfair Sales Act. It became part of the law under 1997 Wisconsin Act 55, a piece of legislation that was enacted in December of 1997, published in January of 1998, and made first effective on August 1 of 1998. Before that date, August 1, 1998, the Unfair Sales Act had not afforded a private litigant the right to sue a competitor for damages arising from a violation of the Unfair Sales Act. Earlier versions of the Act had allowed a private party to sue for injunctive relief, seeking to forestall a competitor's future or continuing violations of the Unfair Sales Act, but none of the earlier versions provided the remedy of money damages. In considering whether a constitutional jury trial right attaches to the invocation of the new private remedy under the Unfair Sales Act, I think it's important to note how limited that private remedy is. Although the Unfair Sales Act generally addresses below-cost selling pricing of all merchandise, the private remedy of sub 5M allows an action by one competitor against another to recover for monetary injury only in the sale of gasoline, motor vehicle fuel. There is no private right of action to sue a competitor for damages arising from a violation of the Unfair Sales Act in the pricing of liquor or window cleaner or milk or paperback books or other consumer products, with one very recent exception, which just became part of the law with the newly enacted budget bill 2001 Act 16, which now creates a private cause of action with regard to tobacco products. I emphasize the limited scope of the private remedy of sub 5M to demonstrate what I think is the key and determinative fact, that this new private remedy is strictly of statutory origin.
Well, suppose you didn't have this statute,
right,
the way the Fair Sales statute, and your competitor is selling under market. Would you have a cause of action?
No. And that's really, I think, the way to phrase this question is to look at it and say, in the absence of the statutory authorization, could you bring this action and could you survive a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim?
And an unfair, under the general common law doctrine, not an unfair trade practice, not a fraud on your competitors?
Fraud on the competitor, no. Typically, the fraud would be if they were pricing deceptively and creating a fraud on the consumer, perhaps there might be something there. But here, we're not alleging that H&S was not actually selling the product at the price they said. We're saying that the price they were selling it at violated the act. And it's only the violation of the act that gives right to the remedy here. Absent the Unfair Sales Act, I don't believe there's any common law cause of action that would have allowed Village Food to pursue this very same claim in a different guise.
Unfair interference with business transactions.
What are the I don't mean to be argumentative, but what are what are the elements of such a claim? I mean, those, I'd have difficulty, as I indicated in my brief in response to Mr. Hinkle's arguments, to these phrases which I think are words without meaning. Business tort, implied contract, competitive injury. Well, that's all fine and good, but when you file a lawsuit in Wisconsin, you have to have elements, you have to know what the burdens of proof are, you have to state your elements, or you're subject to a motion to dismiss. And I have thought very hard as to any of these archaic common law causes of action, Trover and action on the case and trespass on the case and things that we all maybe heard about once when we were in the first year of law school, but I have not come up with any that really are progenitors of this cause of action.
Well, one of the problems is, why do we stop jury trial rights as of 1848? It doesn't say that in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 5 doesn't say only for trials that you would be entitled to a jury in 1848.
It doesn't say that in the Constitution, Your Honor, but it does say that in a whole lot of Wisconsin cases, which are precedential and which extend over 150 years. I think I cited one case, the Norvell case, which I believe was 1851, where it talks about the fact that the Constitution preserves inviolate because it works off of the words of the Constitution that the right to jury trial shall remain inviolate. And many cases, which we've cited in the brief, stand for the proposition that the right of jury trial by jury shall remain inviolate, that is, shall continue as it was at the time of the formation and adoption of the Constitution by the people of this state.
And other states interpret their Constitution that way, and some constitutions, I think, even state as of the time of that Constitution. But one of the issues might very well be that the court made a mistake in Norvell.
Well,
they read words into the Constitution that aren't there, and Justice Prosser raised real questions about Norvell and its validity in a concurrence he wrote in Ebner. Now, that was a different kind of case. It was a criminal case, and it was Article 1, Section 7, as well as Article 1, Section 5, but what do you think of that?
Well, what I think about that is that this court ought to give great deference, due deference, to its precedent. And when decisions are 150 years old and people begin to rely on them, they ought not to be swept from under easily unless there is some compelling reason why all of these other courts got it wrong. And I don't see a compelling reason why these prior courts got it wrong in this instance. There is a constitutional jury trial, right, which attaches as the Constitution has been interpreted. There is also, for statutory causes of action, another venue. The legislature can always grant a jury trial right. And even beyond that, the parties, even if there were no constitutional right, can, under 805.02 sub 2, stipulate to a trial by jury, which will have the same effect as if there were a constitutional right or a statutory right. So I would think that the court would be reticent to overrule 150 years of precedent in order to rethink or refocus the analysis of the jury trial right. I actually think that the standard that Mr. Hinkle is arguing for is simply to say, is it a suit for money damages? If it is, jury trial right, no further discussion, end of story. But that's not what the cases say.
But it's an easy solution.
Yes, there are many easy solutions, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the ones that should be adopted in light of our precedent and our history. Counsel, please.
Why wouldn't you want to submit an appealing case like this to a jury?
Very good policy reasons why not. This is not an attractive plaintiff's case. I think, frankly, the Unfair Sales Act, to be very truthful about this, what I am saying in this case is that H&S Petroleum ought to be found liable because they were selling to the public gasoline at a price lower than they otherwise would have had to charge. Now, juries are made up of consumers, and consumers generally like lower prices. And so to sell the idea that a party who has given them a better deal in the short term, or as a jury might see it, should be held liable for that, that's a tough sell. It's not to say it can't be done. It's not to say that you wouldn't proceed with that action, but to be realistic, it's certainly not the most. You don't have an injured party who's going to be engendering great sympathy. You have none of that. You also have no bells and whistles. This is a highly technical regulatory scheme that talks about things as uninviting as the average posted terminal price and the date of the termination and who is a retailer as opposed to a wholesaler as opposed to a refiner. It's very technical. It's boring. And it is not the type of trial that lends itself easily to a jury. And I think that's an important fact because I think the legislature, when they enacted the Unfair Sales Act, and then many years later, in many different variations of this act, came to 1998 and put in a private remedies section, didn't include a statutory right to a jury trial, even though they are deemed to know when they enacted it what the current status of the common law was with regard to jury trial rights. And that current status was expressed by State v. Ameritech, which, whether you agree with the decision or disagree with the decision, is very clear as to what it says. And they didn't add a jury trial right. I think they very well may not have added a jury trial right because they perceived that the overall goal of the Unfair Sales Act to prevent predatory pricing that would drive small operations like the Shaw's run out of business, it warrants having minimum pricing requirements, which may keep the price of certain consumer commodities higher than they might otherwise be, but has the benefit, which the legislature believes is a benefit worth having, of keeping businesses going, of preventing the big conglomerate from coming in, doing loss leader selling, wiping out the competition, can no longer keep up, and then once they have cleared the field, raising the prices and getting all their money back. Right. I mean, I think that is the distinction in function here between what does the court do. The court has a very strong interest in safeguarding the constitutional right to a jury trial, and I don't mean to undermine that at all. But I think it has to be looked at in the light of what our precedent has told us and viewed in light of what is the legislature's right and their duty in formulating a cause of action of the kind they did here.
Counsel, I understand your argument to be that the right to a jury trial exists only, number one, if the alleged cause of action existed at common law in 1848 when the Wisconsin Constitution was enacted, and number two, the alleged cause of action was recognized as a cause of action at law at that time. Is that your argument?
Right. And that's taken directly from State v. Ameritech in the earlier cases.
What do we do with this? I remember a couple of years ago, and it's a case that this court wrote that garnered national attention because, lo and behold, this court discovered a new tort, a new cause of action, bad faith with regard to HMOs. Now, HMOs, of course, were not in existence at the time of the Constitution, nor was the tort, years before that, this court recognized the tort of bad faith with regard to insurance companies and fire cases and stuff. Is it your position that because the tort of bad faith did not exist in Wisconsin in 1848, even though it is a cause of action at law, that anyone who brings a cause of action of bad faith is not entitled to a jury trial because the cause of action did not exist in common law in 1848?
I'd like to think about it a little bit more, but my off-the-cuff reaction is that no, I don't think the argument goes that far. As I remember reading that case, I think the kernel that gives rise to the bad faith against the HMO is a breach of a fiduciary duty, which the court has described existing between an insurer and an insured. Breach of fiduciary duty is something that existed in common law.
That's a great response.
Thank you.
let me try one more. Tort of wrongful discharge. That's not a fiduciary duty. And we just came up with that not too long ago. You know, we kind of cut it out of whole cloth, some people would say. Did that exist in 1848? Does that mean anyone who brings a cause of action for wrongful discharge is not entitled to a jury trial?
My understanding is wrongful discharge is more in the nature of contract breach than tort. Maybe wrong on that, but I believe that you would look back and you would look to see whether there is some common law analog, a progenitor, if it's breach of contract, breach of an employment contract, if there is an implied duty between the employer and the employee, which would have allowed an employee to bring some sort of comparable action back in 1848, then I think you're solid. Then the jury trial right is preserved. I agree with Chief Justice Abrahamson that the common law continues to develop. Clearly, we're talking about gasoline here. It didn't exist in 1848. I'm not saying that you have no jury trial, right, because we're talking about a computer or something that didn't exist at the time the Constitution was formed. But I think you have to be able to point to a specific cause of action that did exist then.
Let me, if I may, just push you just a little bit further on that. One of the reasons you took a case to task that was assigned cited by your opponent, if I recall correctly, or some of the argument, dealt with, well, that's a contract case, and here we're not talking about a contract case. Well, the tort of wrongful discharge, I mean, there may be based on some contract discussion, but it is a tort that is a cause of action that did not exist as a tort in 1848.
And indeed, the public policy may have to be required to be in a state statute that has been violated in order to get a wrongful discharge cause of action. So you've got a statute, public policy, which may not have existed at the common law. It's been violated. If we have a wrongful discharge, so back into a statutory game.
And I guess the analysis goes back to the same thing. It's a searching analysis. It's not one that one can make without really trying to look. Of action and see what might be analogous. Sufficiently analogous to say something comparable existed at common law that would have given a person not just something to talk about, but a real right of action in a situation comparable to this.
But do you think the court ought to take a broad view of what's comparable at common law or a narrow view?
as to what's kind of...
Well, you know, if you look at the case law, that La Crosse case that we cited in the brief, it was a late 19th century case where they talk about garnishment. And they were talking about garnishment in some instances is legal, a case at law, and thus would have given a jury trial right. In some cases, garnishment is equitable because you're seeking to attach notes and evidences of debt, and they call that an equitable remedy. So there, they were really finely tuning the distinction between cases at law and cases in equity and talking about a remedy of garnishment. So, I mean, I think what our precedent tells me, and that, of course, is what I have to go by, is that you need to find a fairly comparable common law cause of action. It isn't enough to just say, well, a business aggrieved by the action of another business had some rights to pursue the other business without identifying what those rights were.
Let's say, for hypothetical reasons, that you can't, and if you take the narrow approach, as you're saying, the precedent supports, rather than a broad definition, and you can't find, in all good conscience, something with the narrower approach that's really similar to wrongful discharge, then your conclusion is no entitlement to jury trial.
Then my conclusion is that there's no constitutional right to a jury trial. And if parties are aggrieved by that, they should do what parties who are aggrieved by existing law should do, and that is petition their legislature, which could enact a provision saying, in all cases, brought on causes of action developed at common law, including wrongful discharge, there shall be a right to a jury trial upon request of either party. And if that were done, there would not be a constitutional right, but there would be a statutory right, and they'd still have the jury trial. Wanted to go back to a point, and perhaps I've already mentioned this. I think the key question to ask in determining whether H&S Petroleum has a constitutional right to a jury trial is this. Does this particular lawsuit owe its existence to the statute that created the right and the remedy under which it is brought, or does this lawsuit owe its existence to the common law as it had developed by the time the Constitution was adopted in 1848? If this court concludes, as I believe it must, that this lawsuit owes its existence directly and exclusively to the statute that created the right and the remedy, then the court must find that there's no constitutional right to a jury trial. If the legislature had wanted to, it could have granted the right to a jury trial, but for the reasons I've talked about already, it did not, and I think that policy-making decision is one that should be honored by this court.
Counsel, the Ameritech case came to this court on review, and the court divided equally, and therefore it was affirmed without opinion. I have not checked the briefs in the Ameritech case.
I would recommend them to you.
Pardon me?
I would recommend them to you. They're very well written and very well crafted.
That's right. So what was the most persuasive argument in your favor? Then I'm going to ask you for the most persuasive argument not in your favor. Because that's what this looks like to me. This case looks like an attempt as a review of the Ameritech rules.
You know, I thought that Ameritech, truthfully, when I read the briefs, was a much closer call than this case.
Okay, why? That's why I'm concerned.
Because Ameritech arose not only under the Wisconsin Consumer Act, but also under Section 100.18, which is called fraudulent misrepresentations. And here we get into, were there common law causes of action for fraud? I could think, you know, if you analyzed it, you might be able to find something in that regard that would have given you some basis to say there was a common law cause of action. On the other hand, I think what the Court of Appeals actually did, which is look at the precedent, which included the Bergen case, which included Becadal, which included General Union, which included N.E. versus the Department of Health and Social Services, each of which had an express statement saying that if the cause of action didn't exist at the time the Constitution was enacted, there's no constitutional right to a jury trial. And they followed that, and I think more power to them, that's what they're supposed to do. And so I think the result in that case was correct, but I think it was a closer call than this. Here, I just, as I said, I have struggled to think of what possible common law cause of action could be analogous to what we have in this case. And frankly, you know, if there were an analogous cause of action, in the 50 years that the Unfair Sales Act existed before this amendment, why weren't there cases for competitive price cutting, for business fraud, for the various things that this act is meant to stop? And the reason is, there's no such cause of action absent the statutory authorization. So that also, I think, is a little bit of the proof of the pudding. Had there been a common law right, why is it never exercised?
What about the Lemon Law?
I think that the Lemon Law, it does not have a jury trial right that's granted by statute. I would think that you would analogize that to a breach of warranty or breach of contract type claim, and the argument would be that this is an outgrowth of the type of breach of contract claim which was known at law in 1848.
In employment discrimination?
Okay, employment discrimination. I'm trying to think whether that would be a breach of a contract, whether there would be a theory where you breach the terms. I'm not coming up with a good answer on that one. And a tort has to have a duty from one to another. Maybe in there were cases that expressed in 1848 and before a duty from the employer to the employee that would give rise to being a progenitor, that type of action. But it may very well be that the answer analytically is there's no jury trial right. And then I fall back on the position that if that's the case and if that's a bad result, then look to the legislature to make it better.
Are we going to be in a situation that all of these causes of action that have arisen either by statute or by our development of the common law in the last 50 years, I arbitrarily pick that number, are we, if we go with your position, going to be subjected to a number of cases now bringing into question things that in the past seemed to be a bit settled, you know, like the wrongful, you know, I feel like I've read about this in the newspaper, this wrongful discharge case and some of the comments that this court handled that was, you know, a large, large jury verdict not all that long ago that came. Milwaukee. You know, I feel like saying, tell that attorney that there's no right to a jury trial. I mean, are we going to all of a sudden be opening up a can of worms? I think Justice Babbage would suggest that when you open up a can of worms, what you get is worms.
Sometimes some people like worms.
Are we opening up a can of worms to call into question all of these cases, kinds of causes of action, statutory and common law, that have been created in the last 50 years? Now there's going to be a new question. Every creative attorney is going to say, how close does it come in 1848? Are we?
No, I don't think you're going to be opening up that particular can of worms. For example, on the example that Mr. Hinkle raised of the wrongful death claims, as early as 1867 in Potter v. Chicago Northwestern Railroad, there were already trying wrongful death claims in this state to juries. Also, in the statute that creates the right, 895.04 sub 7, there is a specific references to damages found by a jury. So whether or not it's a constitutional entitlement, it's a statutory entitlement, and I don't think there's a question that you would be able suddenly to be inundated with cases where a jury wasn't allowed. Secondly, I think you overstate the problem by saying that people will be running in wondering whether there's a jury trial right, as if the absence or the presence of a jury trial is always helpful to one side and not the other. That's not the case. I think most people who try cases like to try jury cases because you work very hard, you put in your evidence, and then you get a result. You either win or you lose, and you go home and lick your wounds if you've lost, but you have an answer. With bench trials, frequently they're taken under advisement for a very long time, and there's lots more work to be done thereafter. As a practical matter, I think many litigants like jury trials. There are some actions where the information is technical, where you're going to be looking at charts and papers and shuffling things more than you're going to be listening to evidence that are better suited for determination by a court. I think this is one of them. More importantly, this is one of them because that's what our precedent tells us. That's what the analysis of the cases that culminate in State v. Ameritech tell us. And I don't think you can overrule Ameritech without saying we're going to disregard all the cases that went before it. So, I think that's all I have, unless someone else had a different question. Thank you.
Justice Prosser?
Well, let me ask this. Let me state the proposition that the people who drafted the Wisconsin Constitution were farsighted and visionary people, because most of the Constitution is still here and applied. Why would such wise and visionary people say that basically the right to a jury is only going to be determined as of 1848 and not be extended to cases in the future?
I'm not sure I know the answer, but I do know that the people who wrote the Constitution chose the words "remain inviolate," and
they also chose the word "extend."
Shall extend to all cases of law and shall remain in
all cases at law.
Right. I can only tell you that those phrases, those words, have been interpreted in the way they have to sort of cast in stone, and I agree that's what the cases say, that it had to be a recognized cause of action at common law in 1848.
Well, you cited the case of Gaston versus Babcock.
Okay.
It was right after Norval versus Rice.
Okay.
And in that case, it talks about cases at law are properly controversies between parties. That's in the paragraph immediately preceding the citation to Norval versus Rice. Isn't this a controversy between parties?
Certainly.
Isn't this damages?
Certainly, but so was the state against Ameritech Corporation, was a suit between parties. I mean, calling people parties is just what we call litigants. I don't think it makes a difference to the analysis. And I can, you know, if our courts had gone differently, if they had interpreted it differently to adopt the test that Mr. Hankel says and say every cause of action in which money damages are sought has a jury trial right attached to it, then we'd all know that, we'd go about our business and we'd do it that way, but that is not what our case law and our precedent have taught us.
Thank you, Attorney Rotier. Mr. Hankel.
Very briefly and shotgun manner. First of all, I think it should be emphasized that, that it's not quite so facile to say that you're not going to be looking at a lot of cases on the jury trial right, particularly when one looks at housing discrimination, employment discrimination, and I think I can say, I've been researched it with some confidence, that even in a progressive state like Wisconsin, it's quite likely that there were no rights granted to minorities in 1848. I know that there were a lot of rights that weren't granted to females. I know that there weren't rights granted to those who were disabled, and we can go on and on. Same thing with respect to housing. There will be challenges to juries in those cases. I'm sure there will be, unless the court very narrowly limits the ruling of Ameritech or hopefully overrules it. Also, I don't think that overruling Ameritech would have any catastrophic effect on the preceding authorities. I think every one of them can be brought into harmony with the right to a jury trial as I propose it to the court, which, by the way, is not any, I'm not proposing that any case that involves a suit for law entitles a person to a jury trial. I'm rather looking to the common law for guidance for the types of cases that were treated at law, and of course then looking at the remedy. Although granted, as stated in the United States Supreme Court cases, it's justifiable or makes sense to look at the remedy as a more important aspect. Ameritech itself has only been in existence since 1994. I expect that as a matter of practice, it's still not relied on to that extent. I know that in other Chapter 100.18 cases involving consumer fraud, my experience has been in the courts that jury trials are still anticipated and requested and frequently permitted in those cases. Saying that the impact on it in terms of reliance is not as great as if it were 100 years old. Sir. Well, it's a different statute. I don't mean to speak for what the legislature does or doesn't do, but they were amending section 100.30, not 100.18. And that 100.18 Ameritech case, again, that involved a civil forfeiture and an injunction. I think that looking at it, I'd say it's an injunction case.
Do you know what the trial court's ruling was based on in the Ameritech case? And I was reading it. I was struck by, like you said, it's injunctive relief, and Ameritech moved to strike the state's request for a jury trial because it was an equitable action, injunctive relief. The trial court granted that motion, but I don't know on what basis. I mean, when I was reading the Ameritech case, I thought, why did Ameritech take off all this other stuff when he could have just said it's an equitable action, no jury trial? Do you know what the trial court did in that case?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. And it does bring up an important point. Ameritech presumably tactically did that because they thought they were going to get an unfavorable hearing before a jury. And to comment on Attorney Rattier's, one of her arguments, I don't think that whether the right to a jury trial tends to favor one party or another is really a public policy reading for a reason for determining whether that right should or shouldn't exist. But I can't answer your question specifically. I don't know why Ameritech did that. Sometimes appeals are taken on one basis and all of a sudden something else comes into play. One or two other points. points. With respect to the highly technical nature of this case, I don't think it's going to be that technical. It's two small businesses. By the way, I represent a family-owned gas station as well. But it's one small business suing another. There are going to be documents. I think, you know, we have jury trials in antitrust cases that are considerably more complex, product liability cases. The difficulty of the decision facing the jury, while that's a source of criticism in the newspapers and in the insurance and business world, is not the basis on which decisions have been made as to whether somebody does or does not have a right to a jury trial. Unless there are any other questions, that's all right.
If there are not, Mr. Hankel, so I want to thank you and thank Attorney Rotier for presenting these excellent arguments here this afternoon. And the court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:00.